Penguin Random House Audio presents Undercooked, How I Let Food Become My Life Navigator, and How Maybe That's a Dumb Way to Live. This is the author, Dan Adute. I dedicate this book to my brother, Sully. Introduction. I was debating calling this introduction appetizer or amuse-bouche, but then I figured I'd have to commit to the menu thing for the whole book, and there would be dumb chapters called palate cleansers and cheese course, and the end would be called check please, and that would be grating. Oh, also, get used to footnotes. They're my love language. I like food. A lot. It's an obsession. And I'm not just talking about how eating a good meal makes me happy, which, don't get me wrong, it does. A good meal gives me more happiness than almost anything else in life, including sex, money, and sex. Food has an outsized impact on my life, far more than it should in some cases. When you peel back all the layers of the Vidalia onion that is my life, many of the biggest moments reveal some sort of relationship to food. Food has made me a better brother and a worse son. It has given me the best of friends and the worst of enemies. It's made me stay in bad relationships longer than I should have, and it's made me exit great relationships because of dietary restrictions. Food has taken me all over the world and helped make my dining room a destination. It has turned me into a gun owner, an animal rights activist, an arsonist, allegedly. Shout out to Crown Publishing's legal department, and a restaurateur. When most people say they have an unhealthy relationship with food, they mean they eat too much of it or too little. When I say I have an unhealthy relationship with food, I mean it's what gives my life meaning. That's a really dumb way to live your life, as the stories in this book will prove. So why should you listen to this audiobook? Good question. I mean, I'm a comedian, but there are definitely funnier books out there. And I love food, but there are better food memoirs on the shelves. Before you print out your Amazon return label, let me say this. I'm probably the best comedian in the country with a deep obsession with food. So that's something, right? I think. Okay, maybe print the label, but keep it in your drawer for now. And to those of you who bought this book at an independent mom-and-pop bookshop, thank you. Also, I hope your grandkids are checking in often. And yes, I know all these bits are for if you're reading the book on the page, but just bear with me, audio people. I have two fridges in my garage. One is a wine fridge full of bottles from across the world that I've accumulated over the last couple of decades with help from my connections in the upscale restaurant world. And next to it is a deep freezer full of meat from animals I've hunted and butchered. I like looking at these two fridges side by side because they're pretty telling of who I am, my bougie side and my country side proudly on display, powered by the same electrical outlet. But the road to filling these two fridges was not easy and, a lot of times, was gut-wrenchingly unpleasant. Letting your stomach be your guide through life is probably one of our most misunderstood fantasies. We enviously watch food shows where Phil Rosenthal and Padma Lakshmi and David Chang travel the world taking happy bites while beaming for the camera, desperately trying to come up with different ways to say, "This is so good." If I hear Chang say, "This is fucking delicious," one more time, I'm burning down every Momofuku on the planet. And don't worry if you don't get this reference. There's still a ton in this book for you. We all wish we could have that job, and yet the person who invented the genre, my idol Anthony Bourdain, died by suicide. I'm not saying that being a globetrotting foodie who went to the ends of the earth and ate at the best restaurants was what killed him, but it sure as hell didn't save him. Okay, shit's getting dark. Let me bring it back. I once had to vigorously wash my dick in a taco truck sink in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, because I touched raw jalapenos and then took a piss. We back? Good. Also, if you're listening to this, sorry, Mrs. Jimenez. Unfortunately, knowing that food is an unreliable life navigator isn't enough to make me quit my reliance on its busted compass. I'm in too deep. That in itself should be enough to make this book entertaining. The second most translated book in the world is Don Quixote, the story of a guy who can't find his way because he's completely delusional. Dan is close enough to Don, so have fun at my quixotic expense. Oh, by the way, the most translated book in the world? The Bible. I've never read it. Too many dietary restrictions. Chapter 1. Appetizer. JK. I grew up one of three boys. My older brother, Sully, was an amazing athlete. My younger brother, David, was charming, cute, and got all the attention. I had a nondescript, chubby vibe, and like most middle children, was forced to create new ways to get attention. Because my father was born in Iran and spent his formative years in Switzerland as a student, he had a robust passion for food. He did his best to pass down his European trappings to us. He raised us speaking French, drinking wine before our bar mitzvahs, and eating stinky, illegal, unpasteurized cheeses he would smuggle into the States. But neither of my brothers shared his love for la gourmandise, as he'd call it. I, chubby vibe, did. I'm not sure if I actually loved the eating or loved what it got me, an opportunity to bond with him on something my brothers could not. Either way, chicken or egg, as a child, I developed an appreciation for both a perfectly roasted chicken and a sublimely poached egg. I was a finicky little foodie in the making. By age 8, I knew which dishes demanded which fork, and I never got ice cream on my face when eating from even the drippiest of cones. When I turned 9, my parents took me to a Long Island pizza joint. When we entered, I looked at them and said, "It's my birthday and you're taking me out for pizza?" My dad still tells that story with pride. Also, no offense to Geno's of Great Neck. You guys are still the first place I hit up when I visit my parents. I've gotten slightly less pretentious than I was at 9. My dad and I would go to restaurants alone together. While my mom stayed at home with my brothers, he and I would set out on culinary adventures in New York City. And like most adventures, our dining escapades required a uniform. I would don my restaurant blazer, an olive green wool number with brown suede elbow patches, over one of Soli's hand-me-down shirts that had a stain on the breast pocket which my blazer just covered. When I was seated, chunks of flab would gasp for air between the buttons. My khakis had 2 pleats because I wasn't fucking around. My dad, in a handsome suit, helped me tie the laces on my moccasins, and we were off. Those trips are my fondest memories as a kid because I was finally able to enjoy my dad's attention without having to compete for it. We reveled in the most avant-garde foods New York City had to offer. Fresh pizzas at Mezzaluna, impeccable Côte de Bœuf at Leal. For my 11th birthday, dad took me to Le Cirque. Let me repeat, we went to a New York Times 3-star restaurant for my 11th birthday. Quite an upgrade from Geno's. Again, I really love you guys. And I can still recite the menu from memory. There was something called a trio, a holy trinity of caviar, smoked salmon, and foie gras, a silky butternut squash soup with huckleberries, a seared Alaskan black cod that melted in my mouth, then something I had never had before, duck confit, a duck that was cooked in its own fat. The crispy skin and lusciously gamey, unctuous flesh beneath it didn't just create a memory. That memory was nailed a la Martin Luther to the door of my brain. Having this special connection with my dad helped me to be less contentious with Soli and David. I had textbook middle child syndrome. I could have written the foreword to said textbook. But because I knew I had a piece of my dad they'd never get, I was able to let down my guard and become a better brother. My being a better brother to them allowed them to be better brothers to me. Soli and I became best friends. He was my cheerleader, my mentor, my idol. I was a decent piano player, so he convinced me I could be a pro. I was not great at tennis, yet he told me that if I kept practicing, I could be, like him, number one on the college team. He gave me the confidence that helped me eventually become a comedian. You don't try to become a professional comedian without a healthy dose of delusion. When I was 16 and he was 20, we hit our sweet spot. I was having a tough time adjusting in high school because I was weird and eccentric. I had a fucking restaurant uniform, guys. So I'd go visit Soli at Brandeis to get away. He showed me that weird and eccentric were actually valuable assets at university, and that if I applied myself in high school, there was a light at the end of the tunnel. He was right. He saw in me a potential that nobody else did. And my fondness for his wisdom was at its peak. Sadly, it would only last 6 months longer. He got cancer and died. Out of nowhere. Fast. Cruel. Devastating. My parents became zombies of their former selves and eventually took a sharp turn into religion. I veered in the opposite direction. We'd been raised pretty lax Jews, but suddenly they became true believers. While they were saying this is all God's plan, I was insisting if God existed, Soli wouldn't be dead. I would try to debate them, but as soon as cracks started to form in their arguments, they would bubble with anger and anxiety. Then I'd scream, "Why can't we just have a normal conversation about this?" And I'd storm out. I realize now that the reason we couldn't have a normal conversation about this was because if I won the argument, the afterlife was a myth, and they'd never see their firstborn again. With religion came kosher laws, and kosher laws killed dining out, at least in the places we used to go. The top echelon of New York City restaurants was replaced with subpar kosher immigrant eateries in Forest Hills, Queens, with fluorescent lighting, sticky menus, and the smell of ferment.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?